Okay, any housekeeping issues to address here? Yes.
I have a question about on your tool, if you have a review section, you can now use time and data.
Right.
Also says on Monday, one section says Wednesday, one section says Monday.
Okay. It should be Mondays from 4 to 5. We didn't do it the very first day of class, and two days ago was a holiday. But we will have that review session this coming Monday, and I can't remember what room it is, but I'll email you the room and let you know Monday when it is. This, for those of you that don't remember that from the syllabus, I do what I call a Q&A. It's basically just, you know, any questions you have that sort of halfway between a, you know, sort of office hours, one-on-one. I want to ask about this, but I want to be the only person in the room when I ask it. And at the other extreme, asking it in class. And I do invite you, in addition to asking housekeeping questions like this, I do invite you to ask substantive questions where there's an issue, as I say in the syllabus, you've tried to resolve, and even, you know, in talking to your classmates, there seems to be sufficient confusion that you think we would all benefit from having me explain, you know, what's the difference between negligence per se and strict liability or something like that. So again, but the Q&A session on Monday afternoon is, as I say, a sort of middle position where you say, I'm not sure I want to take up time in class to do that, but I would like, you know, to have this explained. And when, as he explains it to me, he'll explain it to whoever else is in the room, and I'll benefit from listening to the questions other people have, and so forth. Just for what it's worth, there tends to be a declining enrollment in the Q&A session. In the beginning, people come in part out of curiosity, and they get something out of it, and as the semester goes on, they feel more and more pressure to spend their time on other stuff. But again, it's there for those who want it. Ms. Ma? No, it's in addition. Let me give you my thoughts for what it's worth about that. The student tutor is there in part to allow you to ask somebody who should know the answer what's really going on. See, if you ask me that question, you'll get what I think is going on, and I would like to believe that that's what's really going on. But there are times when you want to ask a student, you know, DeWolf talks about this, but I'm afraid that what he really wants is something different. Tell me what it's really like. Or, do I need to know this? Or please explain it to me. DeWolf has said it three different times, and each time he says it, it still makes no sense. Maybe you can explain it to me. And so this is true in all of your classes. The function of the student tutor is to really give you a different perspective so that my limitations are not definitive. You have another way to get the information. Now, in this class, as with other classes, you have to be judicious about your reliance on the student tutor, because the student tutor, like me, has limitations. So the thing that the student tutor is quite convinced is the thing you really need to know doesn't turn out to be as reliable as you would like. So again, the multiplicity of perspectives can help you kind of zero in on trying to figure out, okay, what is it that I really need to know, or how do I put this in a way that will really do the job for me? And, you know, part of it is experimentation. You try things and you see how well they work. It's one of the reasons why we do these, what I call mini exams. It's really what you would think of as a midterm. This exam, the exam in this class, as I'm sure you do remember from reading the syllabus, there is a an exam that counts 10% on October 6th, first Monday in October, not the Supreme Court thing, but the first Monday in October is an exam. So that counts 10% of your grade for the entire year. So since the first semester is 60%, it counts basically 1/6 of your fall semester grade. And the reason for doing that, essentially a month into the semester, 6 weeks into the semester, is so that you can get an early dipstick reading here, or take your temperature. How well am I doing accomplishing the thing that will be the basis of my grade? And sometimes it's an unreliable indicator. You can have a bad day, you can have the flu, or you can have, you know, a really good day and be lucky on something, and but generally it'll give you an idea, okay, this is how well I'm doing. So all of these things are designed to help you make sort of mid-course corrections to get where it is you want to be. Other kind of housekeeping questions I do encourage you again, I'm not averse to paying attention to the exam process. In fact, I think it's a healthy thing that you're concerned about, well, okay, where does this show up on my grade? And that's not obviously the only reason you're here. You have other purposes for being here besides getting a good grade, but getting a good grade is not an insignificant issue for you, and I don't, as I say, I'm not averse to seeing that as a motivator for us all to adjust our behavior in that direction. So. Okay, well, let's go back then to substance here. We've still been, we spent a little bit of time yesterday on Adams versus Bullock, and again, the takeaway message from Adams versus Bullock is that the standard of reasonable care is incorporates this consideration of, well, safety is good, but there is such a thing as safety that comes at too high a price, and when the price is not one that a reasonable person would pay to get the additional safety, then we can't say that the failure to do that is negligent. We'll come back to as I said before, in United States versus Carroll Towing, to this learned hand formula and all that sort of stuff. But before we get there, we're still getting more insight on this, what I would call an intuitive concept of reasonable care, which is in Robinson versus Lindsay. Do you say Desaya? How do you say your last name? Can you tell us about Robinson versus Lindsay? Okay. Assuming there is such a thing. Having a 13-year-old myself, I'm not sure. Go ahead. Okay, so again, having in mind the difference between what was given to the jury and what the plaintiff claims should have been given to the jury, the standard given to the jury was, ladies and gentlemen, in considering whether you used reasonable care, you should compare his conduct to that of a reasonably prudent 13-year-old. That's what was given. the standard the plaintiff says should have been given is, ladies and gentlemen, considering whether he used reasonable care, you should compare his conduct to, or of a reasonably prudent person. If we're talking about the guy swatting the wasp, we don't say a reasonably prudent adult, we just say a reasonably prudent person. So, similarly here, don't qualify it, the point being, don't qualify it by saying a reasonably prudent 13-year-old, but rather say a reasonably prudent person. Okay? Now, what's the plaintiff's argument as to why you should use the standard of a reasonably prudent person rather than modifying it to take into account his age? Okay. So the plaintiff says that it's okay to give this instruction, to phrase the instruction that way, for certain kinds of activities, but not for this particular activity. What sort of, in what sort of situation would it be appropriate to give the jury the instruction, and considering whether the defendant was negligent, you should compare their conduct to that of a reasonably prudent 10-year-old or 13-year-old? Such as? Biking in the sense of a bicycle, pedal-driven. So if a 10-year-old's riding his bicycle and he runs over somebody, crashes into them, he's riding on the sidewalk and runs into a pedestrian, we would say, did he behave according to the standard of a reasonably prudent 10-year-old? But if he's riding a snowmobile, we say a reasonably prudent person. Why? What's the difference? We would. Of course, we would like for the kid riding the bicycle to behave as a reasonably prudent person, but in one sense we're willing to cut the 10-year-old some slack when he's riding a bicycle or they're playing catch in the street in front of their house, but we're not willing to cut them slack if they're riding a snowmobile. Or what else? Give me some other examples of things a kid might do that would subject them to this reasonably prudent person standard. Okay. It's an interesting question. Let's suppose the 12-year-old is out hunting, you know, goes out with his dad or his uncle or something, and he's got a shotgun, and they're going duck hunting. And then I assume there are some 12-year-olds out there who go with their male relatives to go duck hunting. Would you hold the 12-year-old in that circumstance to the standard of a reasonably prudent person? Or if they have an accident with the shotgun, would you say, no, the standard is that of a reasonably prudent 12-year-old? Why? Okay, so you wind up making, in effect, a kind of public policy determination. And again, this is one of those areas where we kind of see the tort system adjusting the boundaries. You know, who takes the risk, who has to bear the burden if something bad happens. With respect to kids playing baseball or riding a bicycle, we say, okay, society has to, in effect, cut them some slack. The rest of us have to be on our guard. If I see kids playing catch in the street in front of our respective houses, I live across the street from these kids, they go out into the street and play catch. As I go out in the street to pick up my mail, or I'm walking down the street, I got to look out for them. Whereas if they're doing some other kinds of activities, like riding a snowmobile, it's their job as a 13-year-old to climb up to the adult standard, and as the expression goes, if you can't stand the heat, stay out of the kitchen. To the child who wants to engage in adult activities, we say, in effect, you better be prepared. Like Mr. Menlove building his haystack, gee, I'm terribly sorry you're mentally disabled, but you've got to live up to this adult standard. It's not our job to accommodate and look out for you. Now, again, it isn't necessarily so. We can, for example, in looking at hunting, if we lived in a rural community where hunting was a big deal and all young men and young women, for that matter, you know, were introduced into a hunting culture and everybody learned how to shoot a rifle and go out and hunt game and bring it home and eat it, maybe we would say that, like learning to ride a bicycle, where our public policy would say, no, give the boys some slack. It's our job. You see a 12-year-old with a shotgun, you know, take cover. We've got to make it safe for kids to learn how to engage in that activity. Or, again, you could have a rule that is just the opposite, that says doing childlike, but this activity is one where you now have entered the adult world. Where would this boundary lie? Operating a table saw, for example, if you're, woodworking. If you are operating a chainsaw, if you're operating a weed eater, you help your older siblings with a lawn care business, and you're out there with a weed eater, and that has the potential to hurt somebody. Adult activity, childlike activity. Now, the other thing about snowmobiles that makes it desirable to have this adult standard is the fact that they can travel fast enough, and here's a kid covered in, winter garb and a helmet and so forth. I can't tell this is a 13-year-old on the snowmobile. I have an easier time identifying that 10-year-old on a bicycle or the 12-year-old playing catch, or for that matter, the 12-year-old with a weed eater, so that I can know that's a kid I need to sort of adjust my activity to take that into account. I don't need that person to live up to the adult standard. I can let the kid be a kid. It's a lot harder to say with respect to snowmobiles or other motorized vehicles, powerboats, certainly talking about a car. It would be crazy to have a rule that says 16-year-old drivers are held to the standard of a reasonably prudent 16-year-old. Rather than saying, if you get into a car, you live up to the standard of a reasonably prudent adult. So again, as you find the dividing line here between what falls into that category where we adjust our behavior to accommodate the kid, or we say to the kid, you adjust your behavior and accommodate to that of the adult standard, that's a public policy decision. And as a society, we choose where to draw the boundary so that either I have to adjust to somebody else or they have to adjust to me. Okay? Yeah, Mr. Reich? Okay, yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, tell me what you do with a 12-year-old who's operating a chainsaw, helping his family or somebody go out into the woods in the fall and cut wood, load it onto a pickup and bring it home and burn it in their fireplace. Right. Okay. What about a kid operating a table saw? Helping, you know, make stuff, cabinetry. What about the kid operating the wheat? Well, tell me about the table saw. Okay. What about a kid using a power drill? Okay, so a kid using a power drill is held to the standard of a reasonably prudent person. Now, I could come at it the other way. I mean, what I'm doing, the old salami technique, you know, I'm just taking a slippery slope here. I'm just moving you ever so gradually from, you know, one position to the other, and pretty soon I've got you applying, you know, a bicycle could cause grave harm to the child and to others. You could run into somebody, the kid could get run over by a car. But I don't think we're going to apply that to the standard of riding a bicycle. I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just pointing out the fact that all of these standards, though we have this rule in our mind, the application of the standard is always going to identify some gray areas where I'm not sure how the court would come out. And by the way, that is a typical exam type question. When sadistic law professors, but I repeat myself, you're supposed to laugh at that one. When law professors think up exam questions, they choose things like, you know, that are designed to give you a question where you would say, well, gee, if I were the plaintiff, I would argue this, and if I were the defendant, I would argue that, so that it forces you to explain the rule rather than essentially questions which are nice black and white things where it's easy to say, well, it's this rather than that. Some questions will have that nice, neat, clear, hey, I've got the rule, here's how the rule applies, here's the conclusion, but oftentimes exam questions will contain at least some issues where you say, gee, that's kind of a tough question. I'm not sure how this principle of adult activities as compared to child activities would apply. And again, one of the things that law professors like to see sometimes is where you have that boundary question is an explanation of the policy behind it. I'm probably less interested in policy than most professors. That is, I'm more interested in having you explain things to your client in ways that help your client make decisions. And sometimes the policy is very interesting to those of us who sort of think about these things, but the client's less interested in what, you know, that there's a split between the Ninth Circuit and the Fourth Circuit over the standard of blah, blah, blah. They just want to know, well, how does that affect me? And I often analogize the practice of law to the practice of medicine. When you go to a doctor and say, hey, doctor, my knee's been bothering me. What can you do for me? On the one hand, you do want some explanation of how the knee works so that whether it's medication or exercise or perhaps some kind of surgical intervention, why that might make a difference and so your knee would function a little better. But there comes a point at which it's a lot more interesting to the doctor than it is to the patient. And the fact that, well, gee, there was an interesting study in the New England Journal of Medicine that said, you know, that blah, 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 and there's the meniscus and the this and the that. Well, whoa. Tell me how that really comes down to, should I just take Tylenol, you know, when it begins to bother me, or should I consider surgery, or what? But sometimes you will be right at that point where you can say, here's the dividing line, and it depends on how this thing turns out. So, for example, it may be there's a study that I happen to know about at Johns Hopkins where they're testing some new medication. If it turns out this medication does all these cool things and doesn't have any bad side effects, that's what you ought to do for your knee. Well, great. If this cutting-edge research really addresses my patient's need, by all means, I ought to tell my patient about it. But there is a temptation among law students to tell things on an exam that shows how smart they are. And while I am interested in how smart you are, what I'm really interested in is your ability to advise your client in helpful ways, which oftentimes simply saying, here's the rule, why it's the rule, would be a fascinating side discussion, but it's not particularly relevant right now to the client. Here's the rule, here's how I think it would apply. You could make this argument, but it really, that argument doesn't make a whole lot of sense in this context. And so you work your way through the problem that way. There's another hand out there. Yes, ma'am. Well, it here's how it would be relevant. Later on in Chapter 4, we get to something called parental immunity. So that one thought you might have would be, could I hold the parents liable for making a bad decision with respect to giving this snowmobile capable of going 45 miles an hour to a 13-year-old. Love my 13-year-old wrong, but the way the hormones are surging through his body, he starts thinking things are really cool that are really quite dumb. And in light of that, it would be a poor idea, perhaps, that would be your argument, to say, gee, the person I'm really looking as a responsible party here is the person that gave the keys to this snowmobile to a 13-year-old and said, hey, you know, go have some fun. But in Chapter 4, we start to get into the questions about, well, exactly how, as a society, do we want to relate to, how do we want to deal with the relationship between parent and child? There are all kinds of, again, social policy ramifications about what effect would it have if the tort system began to insert itself into the decisions parents make about the raising of their children. So we'll get to the parent issue later on. Right now we're only looking at the question whether this 13-year-old behaved responsibly. It would be very logical to ask the question, well, wait a minute, he didn't go down to the store and buy himself a snowmobile, I'm quite sure of that. And so the question would be, who else might we look at? Mr. Breck. Yes. Now, the trial judge gave an instruction, and then after the trial judge said, oops, I goofed. Yeah. Occasionally. Most of the time, trial judges, I mean, it's not that trial judges have the belief that they're infallible, but judges, precisely because they know they're not infallible, and that they're constantly calling balls and strikes, admissible, inadmissible, sustained, overruled, admissible, inadmissible, they're making so many decisions that they could easily second guess. And the losing party says, but judge. And the judge eventually gets, sort of like a parent, to say, that's it. I made my decision. Live with it. Don't bother me. So even when judges have significant doubts, I think I messed that one up, they're more inclined to just say, I'm going on, rather than to go back and relive it, and also to sort of encourage disappointed litigants to harass them some more, you know, that if I just hammer this judge long enough, they're going to change their mind. So judges tend to be a little more rigid on these things. This is an unusual thing where the judge does something, and shortly after he does it, he says, oops, I goofed. Well, because the defendant says, judge, you were wrong when you thought you were wrong. So that's how it gets there. Yeah. Again, I think that would have to do with the question of whether or not he was using reasonable care. If he was driving this thing without instruction, you might say that by itself was a, you know, negligent thing to do, even if his particular, you know, the way he got it, anyway. But it wouldn't necessarily say by having a license it sort of baptizes whatever he does, and the fact that he didn't have a license doesn't by itself prove that he was negligent. Okay, let's talk about Carroll Towing here. As I said, this is the way in which the generic or intuitive concept is given a kind of mathematical, quantitative aspect. Mr. Palmer, can you tell us about Carroll Towing? Okay, so this person responsible for the barge is apparently called the bargee. I don't know if there's a barger, but there is a bargee. And so the question before the house has become, was the defendant, the owner of the barge, negligent in failing to have a bargee there to monitor things and prevent it from coming loose and then doing something about it after it began to take on water? Now, what's interesting in this case is Judge Learned-Hand's proposition to us about how we should make that decision. What's his suggestion or method? Okay, and he puts this in the form of an equation, and so these variables stand for these factors to be considered. The first one you said was the probability that a bad thing would happen. What are the others? Okay, and he gives that term the designation L. So again, this is the probability of harm. L is what? We might call it the magnitude of harm measured, I guess, in dollars. Are we talking about a barge full of trash that was refuse that was being hauled out to be dumped at sea? Are we talking about a you know, some precious cargo of, you know, rare historic, you know, stones or something. What's at stake, basically? And the third variable here, which he labels B. And the way he sets this equation up is, how does he set this up? Okay, so in theory, if I'm tracking this, we could decide whether the defendant was negligent if we knew or if we assigned numbers to these variables. And just to see how the mechanism works, making up these numbers, let's say the burden of having a bargee on board was $50. Let's suppose the probability of something bad happening was 1 in 100, 0.01. And let's suppose the magnitude of loss was $10,000. Is it worth it to have a bargee on board? Because when you run these numbers, let's see, 0.01 times 10,000 equals $100. The burden in this case is less than that. So therefore, you would say a reasonable person would pick the less expensive reaction to this situation. Now, by contrast, if the numbers were different, if, as he says, the probability of harm drops, let's say, at night, when there's less activity, if the probability drops because it's no longer wartime and you don't have all this traffic coming in and out, likely to get lines crossed and so forth. So the probability drops from being 0.01 to 0.001. Now the probability drops, or the discounted loss drops to $10. Suddenly the reasonable person wouldn't have a bargee on board. We now have the way of solving all our problems, do we not? Ask me the question whether somebody was negligent, and I'll say, give me the numbers. Show me the money. Tell me what these relative variables are. What would it have cost? What was the probability of harm? What's the magnitude of the loss? Not in a particular case, not how much was this particular loss, but in those cases where you can't predict, but you have a sort of general sense of the magnitude of loss, that's when you decide whether to take this burden or not. Does he deserve the Nobel Prize in economics here? A beautiful mind? Mr. Harris? Well, you tell me. Do you think it should be?
It's really difficult to set a number on a bike.
When you say it would be difficult in what respect? Just that it's hard to do it, or that it's it makes you squeamish? That you shrink from the Okay. Now, as a matter of fact, as I think, I can't remember whether I even mentioned this, I don't. But later on, in Chapter 3, there's a case involving the Ford Pinto. And In the case of the Ford Pinto, Ford's engineers were trying to figure out, it's late in the game as they're getting this new compact car ready for market. It's in 1971, I believe, was the model year. And they were reacting to a declining market share as imported smaller cars were taking, you know, more sales away from them. So they wanted to get a smaller car that would compete with imported cars. And as they put the prototypes together and then they start testing the prototypes, one of the things they do in the testing process is they do the rear-end collision test. And they discover that at fairly low speeds, like 25 miles an hour, a rear-end collision in a disturbingly high number of cases results in the puncture of the gas tank and the danger of fire. So the engineers report this back to Ford, and then Ford has to make a decision. Do we undergo the burden of changing the design of this car? It's already late in the game. We don't have much time to do this before it's got to be rolling off the assembly lines. And we have to keep the cost of this thing at a point where we can sell it and still make some money. So they used Learned Hand's formula, and they figured out what's it going to cost per car. They figured it would cost about $11 per car. And they had pretty good statistics about how likely it was that any given car would be hit from the rear at a speed greater than 25 miles an hour. And I forget what that number was. But it was a pretty small number. Let's say it was a number like this. You know, 5 in 100,000, if that's the right, if I got the decimal in the right place. Now comes the tricky part. What do you assign to the number reflecting the damages from such a collision? Where do you think the engineers went to get that number, Ms. Ma? Yeah, in effect, you'd ask the lawyers, hey, when you have to pay for a burn death or a serious burn injury, what's the payout on something like that? Oh, we got that number. It's about $300,000. They ran the numbers, and they said, you know what? We can't afford to do this. It's way more expensive to put this gas tank, the solution they came up with was essentially to put a nylon, what they call a bladder, a liner, inside the gas tank so that even if the metal of the gas tank gets punctured, the contents will not leak. So they said, too expensive, ship it. And you probably know the rest of the story. When the jury found out about this, the jury was just horrified. They not only made Ford pay for the injury, but they awarded the plaintiffs $125 million in punitive damages because they were shocked. Now, obviously the question is, well, doesn't Learned Hand tell us that's the way we're supposed to think about these things? Or, wherein did the Ford engineers mess up? Was it that they should have used a bigger number? Would the jury said, oh, gee, if you'd used a bigger number, we'd have... Is that the problem? Is it using any number? And, just to be sort of cynical about this, don't tell me that you're not going to use some variation of Learned Hand formula. Don't tell me that everybody's going to go out and say, gee, if it's not a Mercedes or a whatever it is, I'm not buying it. I won't drive it. I won't make it. I won't sell it. Even a Mercedes makes compromises in its design. It's too expensive at some point. Yeah, we could do that, but gee, you know, that would drive the price of the car out of sight. So, in long answer to your question, sort of returning your question with a question, what's going on here? Did Learned Hand, I mean, one answer would be, Learned Hand, you did a great job when you're talking about barges full of flour, but don't even think about using that formula when you're talking about human beings. A different answer would be, well, look, everybody makes these kinds of decisions. Don't kid yourself. Don't give me this holier-than-thou stuff. You're going to behave this way just like Ford did. You don't want to think about it, but you're just like those Ford engineers. You just don't have a slide rule in your hand or a spreadsheet. Don't tell me, oh, you parents out there of children over the age of five, that you never drove your car with a child without a car seat in the back seat facing backward. I'll put you on a lie detector and say there were times when I had to go to the store to get a carton of milk or whatever, and then I left the car seat of my mother-in-law's, and okay, we'll strap him in the back seat, we'll get to the store, we'll get back, okay, you know, shoot me. What did I do? I said the burden was too great relative to what I thought was a low probability of loss. Yeah, sure, I could get into an accident. Yeah, my kid could get mangled, but I don't think that's going to happen. Come on. Okay, so tell me, what should I be thinking about this? Should we bow down and worship Learned Hand here and say thank you for making our lives so much easier? Should we regard him as the devil incarnate here, leading us into the path of putting a price tag on everybody, where we know the price of everything and the value of nothing. What should we be thinking here? Anybody got a Mr. Sharma? You should run for Congress here. Yeah, go ahead. Okay. And help me tell me where that line is. Okay. Let me push you a little bit. What is the place, if any, of this kind of thinking if we are deciding whether to replace the Trent Avenue Bridge right over here? You know, the Trent Avenue Bridge, which I've been doing without for the last, 2 years. I'm just desperately waiting for them to finish that bridge so that I can get downtown from here without going halfway to Idaho. They replaced that because they thought, I guess, that there was, there were all kinds of structural problems with the bridge, and they spent, millions of dollars to fix that thing. Is there a place in deciding whether to replace that bridge compared to other, ways to spend our transportation money? Is there a place for using a formula like this? Or should we say, no. What's the place of it? So we do a cost-benefit analysis if we're talking about the shuttle, the space shuttle, if we're talking about the design of an automobile, we use cost-benefit analysis. So what did the Ford engineers do wrong? Why is it that the jury, and most of us, I suspect, would be quite shocked at the way the Ford engineers did that? What was shocking about what they did? If we can figure that out, we'll be a long way toward reconciling these things in our mind. It becomes a little bit different, and I'm not sure, if you're doing the space shuttle, eventually you send enough people up in rockets, eventually somebody's going to die, but you at least have the hope that you're going to be able to do this without any casualties. As compared to the Ford engineers who, because you make millions of cars, eventually, and even if you make a Mercedes, you know that some people are going to die in your automobile because you didn't spend the money, but it's a little bit different when you know some people are going to die as opposed to at least having the hope that you'll get through this. Again, it's different if I strapped 250,000 kids into the back seat of my car, knowing that one of them was going to die, but hey, I was too lazy to go get the car seat for my mother-in-law's to go get a carton of milk. It's different thinking, well, I can probably get to the store and back without anything bad happening. Okay? So I do think it's different when you kind of know something bad's going to happen. The other thing I think went wrong at Ford is that this became the sole criterion. It displaced a better question, which is, would you have your son or daughter ride in this, you know, if this is the kind of car that college students are going to buy as their first car, would you feel okay having your son or daughter drive around in the back seat of this car? And I suspect the Ford engineers who made this decision, who said, aye, aye, sir, when their bosses told them, hey, just ship it, those engineers would say, hey, yeah, I never put my kid in that car. That ought to tell you something. So, Mr. Berhau. And we'll come back to that. We've got to quit here, but we'll come back to this thing in Chapter 3 when we read the Pinto case and talk more about it, and we'll pick this up on Monday.